This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me back to the podium. Looking out in the audience, there's quite a few very experienced both carotid surgeons and carotid interventionalists. So what I'd like to do in the next 15 minutes is show us where carotid stenting has been over the last decade and how it may advance here in the future. My disclosures, I am a site investigator for an upcoming carotid stent trial, which I'll be discussing. And when discussing carotid stenting, it reminded me of this figure that I saw in the British Medical Journal about Scott's parabola. And it really is not, it has nothing to do with carotid stenting, but about the rise and fall of a surgical technique. So a technique starts off as a promising idea, initially used as a research tool. There's some encouraging reports and strong pressure for its adoption. And then afterwards, becomes really almost standard treatment without a lot of data. And then soon damaging reports come in, medical legal cases, and it soon falls into disuse. And in these typical British terms, the operating theater staff ponders possible uses for large quantities of expensive obsolete equipment. And the very old surgeons amaze their juniors with the rollicking stories of the old days. So will carotid stenting fall down this parabola? Carotid endarterectomy is really the basis on which we have to compare all technologies. It's a safe, durable procedure with a small incision, a one-day stay, and a very low stroke rate. So really, everything else has to measure up to the bar of carotid endarterectomy. Carotid stenting started off as an alternative back in the 1990s to carotid endarterectomy, mostly in high-risk patients, a minimally invasive procedure, and can be performed by specialties other than vascular surgeons. And the floodgates really opened back, it's a little more than a decade now ago, of 2004 with this New England Journal of Medicine article presenting the SAPPHIRE trial evidence, which was the first randomized trial comparing endarterectomy to stenting in both asymptomatic and symptomatic patients. And it was designed as a non-inferiority trial. A little hard to see the data here, but you can see that when looking at life table analysis with the primary endpoint of stroke, death, and MI, that stenting and endarterectomy were basically non-inferior or equivalent to one another. And the primary endpoint, actually carotid stenting outperformed endarterectomy by 12% to 20%, albeit this is a pretty high rate for carotid endarterectomy. Well, really, this is where it became into full adoption. And we were all really waiting for the results of a really well-designed NIH-sponsored multi-center trial. And the CREST trial was published in 2010, also in the New England Journal of Medicine, with normal risk patients for carotid endarterectomy, but with very experienced both interventionalists and with surgeons with using embolic protection devices in over 2,500 patients enrolled. When looking at the results, I think we all know the results here, that the combined endpoint of death, stroke, and MI were equivalent statistically, 5.2% for carotid stenting and 4.5% for endarterectomy. But when you break down into the subgroup analysis, all stroke basically was improved with endarterectomy, 2.3 to 4.1%, and the difference in the conglomerate endpoint was really driven by a higher MI rate with carotid endarterectomy, presumably because of general anesthesia. So, and this data as far as stroke has now been presented out to 4 years, so a more durable stroke-free survival in carotid endarterectomy versus stenting. The other problem with this is that in the patients that we really want to perform carotid stenting in, the older patients over 75 years of age, in the CREST trial, really, there is a twofold increase in stroke rate with patients over 75, so really is not performing where we wanted stenting to really improve our outcomes. So how do we improve outcomes? And this is really what's going to happen over the next decade to improve. So we've all become much better at the technique and the patient selection in carotid stenting, that now we have pretty standardized pre- and post-operative care, interoperative use of dual antiplatelets and embolic protection. And we know which patients to avoid, too, the patients with circumferential calcification, octogenarians, shaggy arches, and type 3 arches. And so really, with just doing this over the past decade, we've seen an improvement in outcomes. Just from technique and patient selection, improved from about 7 to 8% stroke rate down to about 3%, which is approaching carotid endarterectomy rates in carefully selected patients, that is. And when you're looking at the variation of what can improve neurogenic or neurologic outcomes, certainly operator experience and anatomy really has is the highest driver here. But technology also has quite a bit of variation that can be improved upon and may even be more powerful than the choice between endarterectomy and stenting. So what I really want to focus on the last 10 minutes or so here is on stent design and on embolic protection strategy. So first I'll be discussing the newer stent trials using closed cell stent design. So carotid stent design, obviously the stent should be deliverable, low profile, conformable to tortuosity, resistant to long-term fatigue, resistant to fish scaling or the metal struts of the stent overlapping each other, and the ability of the stents to trap the lesion. So clearly there's a difference between the traditional open cell stent design with fewer communications between the interstices or a very smaller lattice work using a closed cell stent design. Well, we know from performing carotid endarterectomy that plaques are heterogeneous and they can extrude a lot of material which can form embolic debris later. And this in this postmortem panel here to the right showing a carotid stent with embolic debris that's extruded out between the stent interstices. We can also see this interprocedurally with high-resolution IVUS where you can see with these arrows that the material here exuding through the stent struts. Well, we know there's a difference between different stents with their stent free cell area and closed cell stents such as wall stent, exact, and neck stent with a much lower free cell surface area rather than open cell stents such as the AcuLink. And this really changes not only the geometry of the stent but also its ability to trap plaque. Well, does this make a difference clinically? Well, this is one study we might remember, the SPACE trial, which was performed was released before the CREST trial, which was a failed trial in Europe that was closed early. But when you look at a post hoc analysis of patients that received either a closed cell stent versus an open cell stent, there's about a twofold reduction in neurogenic outcome rates based on just the stent design alone. Also, from other trials, we see that a lot of the strokes that occur after carotid stenting are delayed. They occur after the embolic protection is removed. And in this study by Bozers in 2007, two-thirds of strokes occurred after the removal of an embolic protection device up to 30 days afterwards. And you can see that there was a difference here, a protective effect, with using a closed-cell stent design versus open-cell stent design. And even in our carotid, our CREST trial, well-designed trial, we see that about 40% of the events that we saw in the stenting group, 19 out of the 29 events, occurred more than 24 hours afterwards. And presumably this is either due to late emboli from the plaque itself or from thrombus. So this has been taken advantage of by a number of different corporations in designing closed cell stent designs. And these are some of them that are undergoing trials with the Medtronic Cristallo Ideal stent, the C-Guard by Inspire MD, the Road Saver, which is a Terumo microvention trial I'll be talking about, and Gore has a proprietary closed cell stent design, which is covered with their proprietary PTFE. So when we look at the differences here in the free cell area, when you're looking at these newer closed cell stents, they're much smaller than the traditional closed cell stent. You can see here with ranges of 165 microns to 500 microns as compared to traditional closed cell stents of about 1,000 microns or open cell design with over 2,000 microns. So clearly they're changing the technology behind these stents. Well, where are we with the data behind this? Is this working? Well, there's only one trial, the C-Guard trial, that went through a Clarinet study in Europe that's gained CE mark, and the Road Saver trial, while it has some clear road data that I'll show you, there's no current data for the new Gore carotid stent trial. The clear road stent, again, this is a Terumo stent. Its design is that it has a smaller lattice work of a stent inside a larger, more conformable stent, so really a two-layer stent. And this was investigated with a 100-patient trial, single-arm trial in Europe looking at stroke, death, and MI at 30 days and stroke within 1 year. Unfortunately, they had a optional use of an embolic protection device, less than 60%. But the outcomes with this, using this new stent design, were actually amazingly good, only a 1% death and stroke rate and overall 2% MAE rate. And you can see here on these angiograms the ability of the stent to, one, conform to tortuous anatomy, and two, have increased coverage in the embolic area of the lesion and very good opposition to the wall with intravascular ultrasound. The other stent, this is a C-Guard stent. This has a PET lattice work. This is the smallest interstice size of the current closed cell stents. This had a smaller trial, albeit only a 30-patient trial in Europe, looking at endpoints at 30 days in 1 year. But interestingly, they also looked at embolism using diffusion-weighted MRI, and I'll show you some of that data. But their clinical outcomes, albeit only in 30 patients, were excellent. There's no stroke, death, and MI out to 30 days in these patients. And this is what I really found interesting when you're looking at new diffusion-weighted images on MRI, which they carefully looked at, with using this closed-cell stent design. One, they, when compared to other carotid stent trials, these are traditional carotid stent trials, there's about a 50% reduction in the number of diffusion-weighted MRI lesions that are seen post-procedurally, as well as about a 90% reduction in the volume of the diffusion-weighted MRI lesions, so meaning that there's fewer emboli, and if the emboli do get through, they're much smaller. Shifting gears now, looking at new embolic protection strategies, I'll talk about new proximal protection strategies and flow reversal. And there's been three devices that have really been looking at proximal occlusion for embolic protection. The Gore or Perotti device was a device that I really liked. I use as my primary device. However, because of its expense, its difficulty manufacturing and support, it was removed from the market. So really, there's only two things out there currently that I'll discuss. One, the MoMA device, which is a flow arrest device, not a flow reversal device, and then the Silk Road device. But the benefit of both of these devices is that it allows you to have protection prior to crossing the lesion. So the MoMA device really is a flow arresting device. It has two balloons, one proximal in the common carotid and one in the external carotid. This was investigated using the ARMOR trial, which was a 225-patient single-arm trial in the U.S. and Europe, looking at high-risk surgical patients and looking at endpoints out to 1 year. And when you look at the 30-day data for death, stroke, and MI, looking at both the intention to treat analysis and roll-in, we're seeing improved results here with proximal protection, with a less than 1% death rate and a less than 2% stroke rate. The other the device I want to talk about is the Silk Road device. I know there's many people in the audience that are currently using this. Is a minimally invasive technique, but really a hybrid technique using proximal protection by clamping the common carotid artery at the base of the neck through a small cut down, and then using a flow reversal system, an extra anatomic flow reversal system. The benefits are it can be done just under local anesthesia, minimally invasive through a small cut down with reversed cranial nerve injury compared to endarterectomy, but really it avoids navigating difficult arches, and this is really the defining technical problem that we have with performing carotid stents as difficult arches and creating debris prior to the placement of the stent. Really, we're talking about type 2 and type 3 arches, at which there's very difficult time cannulating the arch, as well as difficulty with calcified arches and proximal disease. So this is the Silk Road system. If you haven't seen it, there's a cut down at the base of the neck with a proximal common carotid clamp. It's a 6 French sheath, and then it has a reversal mechanism, which can be run at either high or low flow rates, reversing blood, going through a filter, and then returning it through a femoral puncture. The nice thing is it can be used with any 6 French carotid stent system you want, does not need distal protection, and avoids arch navigation with a pretty simple closure of a 6 French puncture of the sheath. Their trial, the Silk Road trial, the Roadster pivotal trial, really used very complex patients. About 2/3 of the patients were over the age of 75, a quarter were symptomatic, and about 50% had physiologic high-risk factors. And in this high-risk trial, they had, when you're looking at the pivotal group with intention to treat analysis, there was really a very low stroke rate, 0% major strokes out to 12 months. 1% minor stroke and a less than 3% combined MAE rate, or stroke and death rate, I should say. And looking at the patients we really want to treat, the high-risk patients, either age greater than 75 or symptomatic patients, there were no major or minor strokes, and excellent results in both the symptomatic group and in the elderly group, where we really have worse outcomes with carotid endarterectomy. And also looking at diffusion-weighted MRIs, they looked at this with the in this proof data. But when there's about the equivalent rate of having new DWI MRI images, about a less than 20% rate with carotid stenting using the flow reversal system, and it's comparable to doing clamp and back bleeding through carotid endarterectomy, and about one-fourth the rate as with traditional transfemoral carotid stenting. So in conclusion, what we've seen is that periprocedural stroke and death rates in patients undergoing carotid stenting have decreased over the last 10 years, or last decade. This trend is partially due to improvements in technique and patient selection, which we all have done, and increased operator experience. But I believe that the next generation stents and embolic protection strategies may further improve the performance of carotid stenting, and it may not fall on this downside of the curve of Scott's parabola, and instead having improved results compared to carotid endarterectomy. Thank you.
So we have questions. I have one question. So I was impressed with Dr. Westmore's secondary analysis of the CREST trial. With length of lesion, do you use length of lesion as a criteria to say yes or no to stenting?
I think that's one of the other high-risk features of the plaque itself. Certainly, the more high-risk plaque, longer plaques, more heterogeneous plaques, I think are all going to be higher risk, as well as circumferential calcification. So I think that all comes down to patient selection, Joe, and that's something that we've all learned which lesions to avoid.
Dr. Lane, thank you for a nice presentation. I'm Wade Smith from UCSF, and I'll follow up a little bit but in my talk. But I was it's really fun to see us turn full circle and go back to direct carotid access. Can you tell about your experience with carotid dissection or damaging the common carotid with direct puncture? And secondly, could you comment on how long it takes before getting access to the time that you can stent, because there's consideration of doing this access for acute embolectomy and acute stroke, because it's a shorter distance. All the issues you describe about having to go through the arch and all are mitigated by direct access. I'm sort of curious about how quick this procedure and safe it is.
Yes, so I am not one of the trialists in the Roadster trial, so I would defer that. There's people in the audience here, Dr. Schneider and Dr. DeRoberis, that both have been trialists there. But the length of the procedure is very short. It's about a 45-minute procedure, which is considerably shorter than most people can do an endarterectomy safely. And then as far as your question about avoiding carotid dissection, I think that can be a problem, especially with very deep and thick necks if you're having a very acute angle upon entry with the device. So I think that can be an issue, and certainly there's going to be a learning curve. But those of us that are comfortable with doing carotid endarterectomy, cut down on the neck, I think is safe and can be done even in the deep neck, which I think is the real issue there. As far as other neurointerventional techniques that can be done through the base of the carotid cut down, I look forward to hearing what your thoughts are, and maybe Dr. Schneider has some more comments on it that he can share with us.
So we've been doing TCAR for a little while, and it is there's definitely a learning curve, but it's pretty straightforward. Most of the procedures take about 45 minutes. We actually do them under local with the little cut down. We've not had a problem with injury to the common carotid, but I think we're pretty careful in selection. And so there's got to be an adequate distance between the clavicle and the bifurcation, and not have a neck that or a carotid that's too deep so that you're apt to have difficulty or to get an injury. But the dissection issue is usually when you do the puncture, if you're just not careful with your needle puncture, and if you create a little dissection in the common, that could be an issue. But we've actually found it, in at least my own bias is, and based on the data that John shared, is that I think this is by far and away likely the most safe way to do carotid stenting. The trade-off is an incision, but usually that's a fairly minor deal, and once you get through the learning curve, it's pretty straightforward.
So I guess my question would be, the study had 26% symptomatic. And I'm curious, for those of us who practice at stroke centers, we have about a 26% asymptomatic, and probably more than 50 and probably approaching 70% of our patients are referred directly from the stroke service acutely. So is carotid stenting going to be relevant for someone who has an acute stroke and a hemorrhagic lesion? Because our practice has completely flipped, and we're probably doing it approaching 70%. symptomatic, acutely symptomatic patients. I'd love to see an asymptomatic patient come in that we could think about this.
Yeah, well, that's why I think some of this new technology is going to be good for treating the symptomatic patient, both with proximal protection and with these more vulnerable lesions that can be treated perhaps better with the closed cell stent design. So with the combination of doing that, yeah, I think we've all seen an increase in symptomatic patients in our practice. I'm doing less asymptomatic patients in my practice currently, but I think some of these new technologies that I presented have the promise to be able to treat those patients well.
I have a question about the study you mentioned that made embolic protection optional. Is that not considered the standard of care to use an embolic protection device, that they made it optional, or do you understand the reasoning behind that for that study design?
No, I wish I could explain it. I mean, it certainly is standard of care here in the United States. In Europe, where this some of this data was from, where they used optional embolic protection, I think it was because they left it at the direction of the interventionalist, and I think that's some of the weaknesses of trying to translate not just carotid data, but from any European data and translating it to the United States, where we have really a different standard of care and different practice.
And then, one other question. This may not be totally relevant to what you talked about, but I can't think of any other part of the program to ask this question. But the question of whether or not we should be intervening on asymptomatic patients, I really love to get an update every year at this talk. CREST-2, I thought, was going to give us more information, but I have not heard any updates myself. And then, the question of always, I can't remember the last time I heard ACAS referred to, but, doing endarterectomies on asymptomatic patients with 60% stenosis, I think, is almost unheard of, although there's people that still probably do that. And then the other question is, stenting is still illegal in patients, CMS patients, who are not high risk for surgery and greater than 70% stenosis. So outside of an IDE, where are we stenting these other patients?
Right. Well, some of it is people that are involved in registries and trials. That's where we're really getting into stenting into asymptomatic patients. So I think that's where this data is coming from.
Is the hope that we're going to get CMS to change their mind? Is that basically the plan? Because it doesn't serve any purpose outside of the IDE.
Well, that's not my purpose, certainly. And I think I'm still a pretty firm believer in carotid endarterectomy. And I think that we've all changed our practice with better medical care, to the first part of your question, that probably our thresholds are now increased, and most people are not doing endarterectomy on asymptomatic patients until they reach 80% or greater. The 60% from ACAS, I don't think, really is currently in clinical practice. But I think that's where there is data still being gained about the use in asymptomatic patients. Certainly, CREST-2 is going to tell us a lot more about medical care. I think that's a very pertinent question, and we're going to be one of the CREST-2 trial sites in the medical arm as well. And so I really is something that I think carotid practice is still in a state of evolution, not only because of new technology in procedures, but also in better medical care, I think, is really where we're going to make the biggest inroads.
So CREST-2 is ongoing. We are one of the top 10 recruiting sites at the San Francisco VA, which is a 110-bed hospital. So what does that tell you? It tells you recruiting in the outside is going very, very slowly. Wade, do you know where we are now? We're at 500, I think.
About 500 of 2,000.
Yeah. So it remains to be seen as to how close to 2,000 CREST-2 actually gets. There's an abstract that I think will be presented at the vascular meetings, looking at the CREST-2 recruitment data, showing that in private practice, the recruitment is going extremely slowly, whereas in the VA and other places where we have, it's admittedly a unique relationship with the patient, but there's also not a monetary issue. It's going along pretty well. And I think the take-home message from that is, if we don't recruit these patients and get them in the trial, I don't think we're going to be happy with the analysis of a trial that is not powered to actually come up with the data to show that intervention is better than medical therapy.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.